Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk about Les Miserables, Mothers and Sons, Aladdin, Cirque du Soleil's Amaluna, Oliver at Trinity Rep, Music Man at NJ Pack, and Hellman versus McCarthy at Edmonton Theatre Company. So please stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Broadway Videos this week on Broadway for Sunday, March 30th, 2014. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Stripper, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critcherland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Hello, Peter.
Good day.
Good to see you again this week. Thanks. Michael Portantier is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Hello. So we're going to jump right into the reviews this week, and because we have so much to cover, and let's start off with the double revival of Les Miserables. I'm not sure what to call it at the Imperial Theater right now.
Second row.
Peter, Michael, and I got a chance to see it. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
Sure. Let me start with the good. We were privileged to have Ramin Karimloo, I hope I'm saying it right, on our podcast several weeks ago, and I thought that he did it. An excellent job as Valjean, not only because of his beautiful voice, but I really appreciated the fact that he was not overplaying as so many other people in this production did. I imagine it would be rather difficult to overplay Valjean, but I'm sure it could be done. And so I bravo to him for not doing it, because if that had not been the case, I think it would have been a kind of unbearable evening for me. Also, similarly, I would say much the same for Will Swenson in the incredibly difficult role of Javert, who really does not change much at all or at all during the show. Just this remains this force of implacable, representing the law, being applied, regardless of what, you know, people's life circumstances are, and no concept of leniency or mercy or forgiveness. I would never, even if I had the voice, I would never want to play Javert. I think it would be extremely, extremely difficult. But he did, I thought he did an excellent job. And also, in several recent shows, it seemed to me that Will was having some kind of vocal difficulties, including pitch. But on this case, I thought he sounded excellent. I think a lot of it maybe had to do with the fact that a great deal of it was in the lower part of his range. And there was one high note in Stars, I suppose, that was not quite there. But other than that, he seemed pretty rock solid on pitch, and that plus his acting really made me. I would say that he was the most effective Javert I've ever seen. So that was a very pleasant surprise for me. Let's see. Other pluses, although I understand the orchestra for this production is 7 pieces fewer than normal, I believe. I think I've heard it's 20, and it had always been 27 in the original production anyway, and maybe the other short-lived revival. So although that's a considerable amount of people, I have to say it sounded wonderful to me. I was not conscious of any weakness in the orchestra, and particularly the string section sounded nice and full. So that was great. And on top of that, I thought this show had one of the best sound systems that I've heard, because so many shows just blast at you nowadays in an attempt to make an effect, and this was not the case. The only time that I felt a little assaulted by the sound in this production was during the gun battle at the two gun battles at the barricades, but those were didn't last very long, and actually it wasn't that bad either. They did an effect with bullets coming at you from all sides of the theater, which was kind of thrilling in a way and a little disconcerting in another. But just so you know, that's what happens there, and that really was kind of interesting. Let's see. The Adam Monley in the very small role of the bishop, I thought was excellent, and Andy Mintis as Marius, I thought was really quite good. Another role that can be difficult for different reasons, because he's relatively weak in comparison to some of the other characters, all the other characters. But I thought he just had it exactly right. What else? I tremendously disliked it overall, because I tremendously disliked the show overall, and I think they made a lot of it worse. I thought I was going to despise the whole thing when it opened, because in that opening chorus, "Look down, look down," every single chorus person who had a solo line was schmacting to the utmost degree, and most of them decided to scream their lines rather than sing them, and not a single person sang the notes with the proper rhythms or note value or pitches. And I thought, well, I guess you're doing this because you want to have your parents or your aunt in the sixth row know that it's you, but that's not the point. I mean, this is an ensemble moment of all these people, these prisoners just being, put through this incredible, this forced labor that's really awful and difficult. And you're not supposed to, just prove what a star you are at that point. So I thought that was really bad. And then, although, as I mentioned, several people are to be commended for not overacting, the people who did overact did it so disgracefully and shamelessly that I can't even describe it to you. Now, I hasten to say that obviously the two directors credited for this production, Lawrence Connor and James Powell, must have a great deal of responsibility for that. Because even if the actors themselves decided to pitch their performances at that ridiculous level, it should have been the job of either or both of those gentlemen to tone it down. The both of the Thénardiers were disgustingly vulgar, and to me, not remotely funny. Like doing cartoon in unbelievably exaggerated humor throughout. And I'm not even going to mention the name of the woman who played Madame Thénardier, because I very much loved her in another show just a couple of years ago, and in this, I wanted to get on stage and slap her. It was so disgusting. Now, I hasten to add, in the interest of full disclosure, that the audience ate it up. Every time they did something ridiculous, like Thénardier diving at her at one point and landing with his head in her crotch, or the 2000 moments when one or both of them were grinding their hips in order to show, what sluts they are, or the incredibly embarrassing fat joke moment when Madame Thénardier grabbed a piece of the wedding cake and started eating it in the middle of the Marius Cosette wedding at the end in front of the entire company. I just could not believe what I was seeing. So I would be interested to hear what people think about the Thénardiers, because as I said, the audience really seemed to love it. And you can't, you know, normally I always say that laughter is the true indicator, because people don't usually laugh if they don't really think something's funny. Although sometimes they laugh if they think something is supposed to be funny, you know what I mean? And maybe they know that about Les Mis by this point. Anyway, that's what I felt about them. Nikki M. James, completely the wrong kind of voice for Eponine, and apparently she cannot learn the song properly. There's one line that she keeps singing incorrectly, according to several sources, and at the performance I saw, that renders the song completely meaningless. Cassie Levy, I thought, didn't make a tremendous impression either way on me as Fantine. I didn't think she was bad, but I wasn't moved. And again, it's not precisely the right kind of voice. Let's see. I've said this so many times before, but I guess as long as they keep bringing Les Mis back, I can keep saying it. It's so stupid the way so many melodies are repeated over and over again with in situations that have no relation to each other whatsoever. Why should the song, why should the melody that Fantine sings on her deathbed be the same exact melody, including the bridge, that Eponine sings in On My Own? Why should the melody that the prostitutes sing at the beginning when they're trying to entice their clients be the same melody that the women of the men of the barricade sing at the end to memorialize them? Why should the melody that the bishop sings at the beginning when he's taking in Valjean and comforting him be the same melody that Marius sings in Empty Chairs and Empty Tables? And just when you think you've heard the most ridiculous things of all, why should Fantine's I Dreamed a Dream, which looks like it sounds like it's going to be heard only once, maybe, then suddenly turn up sung by Marius in the finale? It's just ridiculous. As I've said before, the original version of Les Mis was a sort of a song cycle or a series of tableaus issued as a concert recording and with French lyrics, obviously. And in that case, almost none of the songs are meant to function as plot songs. They're much more kind of like commentary or just general statements on the themes of the novel. Although it was a 2-LP set, because that's how long ago we're talking about LPs, I think it only amounts to about 90 minutes or less of music, and that was blown up into a 3-hour plus musical that has very, very little new music written for it. The major exceptions being Stars, I think, and Bring Him Home. So this show has attained untold success throughout the world and on film, and Lord knows there are 4 or 5, I would say, melodies in it that are extremely beautiful, and the original story is so powerful, and I think that's the reason for its success. But as far as the actual adaptation, it's pretty much a complete mess.
All right, so Peter, what did you think about this?
Well, I cannot disagree with Michael at all in the fact of the way the songs have been apportioned. I've always wondered why a melody for Fantine should show up in Eponine's voice much later. So that has never made much sense to me, but I think the music of Les Mis is terrific. And more to the point, my oldest and dearest friend, John Harrison, who's been going to the theater since 1965 when I took him to the tryout of The Odd Couple, who sat next to me at Sherry, Skyscraper, and Holly Go Lightly, said it best, really said it best when he says, I think there's a spirituality to the music, and I think he's right. So I adore the music, and I think it's one of the great scores of all time, even though I agree that I don't understand why songs are reprised by the melodies are reprised by different people when they shouldn't be. However, there's so much music in the show that it's fine with me that that the songs we have that we have. Another thing, I just want to mention that two record set that you talked about, Michael. Les Mis was the second CD I ever bought, and so I didn't realize that the LPs missed a lot of the music that the LP actually started with at the end of the day.
I'm sorry, but I was I was specifically talking about the original French one. But anyway, yeah.
Oh, all right, fine. Yeah. But anyway, yeah. I just wanted to bring that up for those. Many people must have been very confused when they went to Les Mis, and the song that they knew was the opening song wasn't there until much later. Right. But anyway. I agree with most everything Michael said about this revival. I was waiting for him to, I was wondering if he was going to let Nikki James off the hook, you know, because I thought she was really quite bad, but you did include that. I'm going to tell you an experience I had on Wednesday, though, that was quite nice. I was contacted late Tuesday night. Can you help us? We do this after-school program with young kids, and we take them to a Broadway show, and then we have a discussion afterwards. And would you lead the discussion? Because the guy who usually does it can't make it. So I said, sure. And it was so impressive to see these high school students. There were eight of them, one brighter than the other, all followed the show wonderfully. I was amazed, you know, and I mean, it also reiterated to me how many wonderful messages there are in Les Mis. Like, especially for high school kids, where you have to say, you know, whatever fate you have now, you may not have as time goes on. Look at Cosette sweeping the floor. Look at Eponine in her adorable dress. And yet what happens? Cosette winds up having the better life, and Eponine does not. I also brought up the fact that you cannot make a person love you, which I think is something kids should know, too. So we had a wonderfully spirited discussion, and there's no question that this show really touched these kids, as it's touched so many people. What's so spectacularly interesting to me is the fact that, of course, when it opened in London, the reviews were putrid. They really stunk. And why is it that when it opened in America, suddenly the reviews were wonderful?
For that matter, why is it that the last Broadway revival was so short-running? I mean, that's a discussion for another day.
No. I don't see why that that's, as you say, a discussion for another day. But I don't know. 463 performances isn't so bad to me. That had been around. I don't think that's so short. I mean, it was more than a year. My favorite review, of course, is the one that's when it opened in New York, saying it's worth the $47.50 top ticket price. Look how quickly it's changed. You know, it's more than trebled in that time since it opened. But I think this is a very moving show, and I do think that Ramin Karimloo is terrific, especially what really impressed me was the way he held the note, bring him home, that final home. That's a long note to hold, without a vowel, and he does it spectacularly well. So I was very impressed, and I wish the show well. I think it's going to do all right. Yes, it's not the first class production that it really was. I didn't miss the lack of turntable at all. I think it's scenically very pretty. And while I do agree that with Michael so much on the performances by and large, I still think it's good to have Les Mis back in town for those people who have missed it. And you might say, who the hell are they? I mean, everybody's had a chance to see it with all these performances. Yeah, sure. But there have been people who have just caught on to this wonderful thing called the Broadway musical, and now they're going to have a chance to see what is an A-B+ production, and that's good, you know. I mean, so I'm glad it's here, and I was glad to hear this wonderful score again, even if the songs weren't right for certain characters.
And I would say some people have said that they think it looks cheap. I don't think it looks cheap at all.
I mean,
maybe it's a little more spare, but I like the projections.
I
did not miss the turntable, as you said. I mean, so I would not, if anyone thinks they don't want to go for that reason, I wouldn't let that be.
No, I thought that the production was anything but cheap. But it was interesting you brought up the projections, because one of the things that helped me when I first saw Les Mis was the projections that moved the timeline.
Yes, yes.
And I took my son, Justin, who's 10 years old, to go see it with me this week, and he was a little bit confused about how, you know, people grew up so fast and things changed and things like that. And I sort of missed that minor part of it, but I agree.
You better not take him to the last 5 years. Then he'll really be confused. Anyway, go on.
So yeah, no, that's very. When the film comes out, I'm going to have to explain it or re-edit the film.
Uh-huh. Well, that's a good point, and also it bears repeating that I think for at least when the first production opened originally, there was quite a lengthy synopsis of the plot.
Yeah,
in the play.
Yes, that's ever. Right.
And I guess they just people feel the producers, whoever now feel that most people know the story so well that it's just no longer necessary for that reason. But I do think, and I thought at the time that the reason that they felt they needed to have it was because the storytelling is really not that good, and largely because all of it is done in the sung dialogue. I just want to clarify, Peter. I agree with you that much of the music is very, very beautiful and moving. But aside from the repetition, you know, I would say half of the show is sung dialogue, and I think that almost all of that is very, very clunky and poorly written.
Well, as Sondheim says, most of the time when people write Retrostatif, it's because they're too lazy to make them into songs. I think there's something to be said for that.
But I don't think. But on the other hand, I know he always, when he's forced to name his favorite musical, he always says Porgy and Bess, and that is a model as far as I'm concerned. That is a model for how to write recitative or sung dialogue or whatever you want to call it, and make it sound interesting and not just, well, how are you today, Marius? What's going on? You know.
Yeah, yeah, I understand. I can't disagree with that. In terms of everybody knowing the story, I'm going to tell a very quick story about the time when I had two Czechoslovakian immigrants staying with me because a friend said, please, I can't afford a hotel. Will you put them up? He said, I'm buying them tickets to Les Mis. And so anyway, we're walking to the theater and I'm thinking, you know, English is their second language and it's hard to understand lyrics many times. So I said to them, so do you know the story of Les Mis? And the husband said, oh, yes. In our country, we are encouraged to read stories about foreign misery. Isn't that interesting?
So I can't disagree with much of what you've said about it. I'm going to start off by saying that I love the underlying property of Les Mis and that I'm a big fan of the show. I've seen hundreds of productions of it. And that I was tremendously impressed by Ramin, who I just had it here a second ago. We had him on July 29th, 2013. So last summer we had him on and before he had... He was doing something else right before he started back in Les Mis.
And by the way, for those of you who care about these things, he has, or the directors have figured out a way for him to show his body for one brief moment.
Yes. And it's worth it. Shirt off. Yeah.
It's worth it.
And I really loved Will Swenson. I think that's a very difficult role. And the design of the production is interesting. As Peter had mentioned, I don't miss the turntable at all, and I think it's very clever the way they do some of the things. And it's really good. I come down exactly where you guys are, that Nikki James, I don't know what in the world they were thinking. Yeah. She's just, I mean, she's very talented and all, but that's not the right role for her.
Well, ironically enough, this production essentially started at the Paper Mill Playhouse a few years ago before it went on a tour. And I'll tell you, the Eponine they had there was really bad. So, I mean, Nikki James is an improvement, even though she's not very good. So, I mean, that Eponine played at American Idol-y, you know, and it was frightening. And she thought she was marvelous, too. But that's another story.
And I think we made the mention that during the rehearsal period for this production that the original Cosette was let go and replaced. So it was interesting to me that was the person they choose to let go. You know, when if it had me, it might have been somebody else. And I also neither of you mentioned specifically the Angel Ross. Did you like him?
Oh, I hated him.
Yeah. Not good. Not good.
I don't know how he didn't inspire. I don't know how he inspired anybody to go to their death. I would have. No, I'm serious. He had no charisma whatsoever. He had pitch problems all over the place.
Yes. Yeah.
It was painful.
Yeah.
It was just painful to listen to him. And it's especially hard because I really love the show. What about the Thénardiers, Michael, when you were talking about how crass they were and are?
Yes.
I sort of feel like that a lot of the things that I can't say, you know, action for action, but much of it seemed to be taken out of the movie where Helena Bonham Carter and what's his name? That guy.
That's a very good point.
Sacha Baron Cohen. The two of them were so over the top and so crass. I think that, and people who have watched the movie over and over and over have come to expect that. And I think that's where Thénardier has to be these days. And
I think that's a very, very fair observation. Yeah.
Well, I see what you're saying, and I think you're probably right. And I think maybe some. I think maybe one or two of the people involved have actually said that to some degree that this production is based on the film.
I see a lot of reflection of different parts of that.
To me, it just was like, you know, it was like dumbed down to the point of it. And it wasn't just the Thénardiers. Do we really need Gavroche to give the finger to Javert?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, I mean, it's again taken out of the movie.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I didn't remember that.
So,
but that speaks exactly to your point. So there you go.
You know, a couple of things before we move on about this is that I felt that some of the changes that were made from the traditional production that we had seen before to this one, I felt that change was being made for the sake of change.
Yes.
I don't see how it benefited anybody to. And how it moved the story forward to have Enjolras die with his back facing the audience, falling upstage behind the barricade,
yeah,
and disappearing onto a wagon where they dripped. You know, because that iconic moment that they had in the original London and Broadway productions of Enjolras dying with the flag, that was so well done in the movie where he got shot in the window and he fell out the window. And then they take him and put him on a cart with this thing. I was like, it didn't show anything that I could appreciate. I really like the candle moment with the women and the after the barricade fell.
Yes, I did too. But can I share one funny story?
Sure.
Comment that someone made, and again, I disagree. I completely disagree that production looks cheap. But somebody said, "Well, of course he's singing about empty chairs at empty tables. There are no chairs and tables." So I just thought that was.
So, Ramin, I want to say that wow,
yeah,
wow. He sang "Bring Him Home" sitting down. Mm. On the barricade for the whole song. I don't know how you sit down and sing that song. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I mean, from a...
No, we know you're
I
not.
Mean, it's hard to sing that song, and for him to be sitting, well, he's got an incredible, incredible instrument. And it's just... I told people, you know, people say, oh, should I go see it? And I say, well, if you like the show, go see it. If you have never seen the show, go see it. If you have seen the show and you're not a fan of it, don't go see it.
Yeah.
So.
That's fair.
Yeah, this won't change your mind. No question.
Yeah. And that's a shame because this is an opportunity missed. And I hope that when they replace the cast with a new Eponine and a new Enjolras, that they will... they will get it right this time. All right, so let's move on to the next thing. Mothers and Sons at the John Golden Theater. Peter and Michael got a chance to see it. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
I was very impressed by this play by Terrence McNally because it more than anything else, it reiterates how far we've come in so short a time. Because this is a story of a married gay couple who have a son, and everything's going along swimmingly until the mother of the older spouse shows up at their apartment. I'm not quite sure quite why she shows up. There's something about returning a book, but of memories and photos, a diary. But yeah, I'm not sure she'd do that. But that said, she's there, you know, and she's played by Tyne Daly, and she is quite the ice queen. She's very unhappy. She's very uninformed about gay life, or she's in denial about it because she accuses the older man of making her son gay, which got quite a nice laugh from the audience that I was part of. So there it was, and he's trying so nice to be nice to her. And, I mean, he's still hurting because he lost his former partner to AIDS. And now after 8 years, he dared to love again. And so here he is, Frederick Rella, with the young, much younger Bobby Steggert. And they're getting along swimmingly, and here's this woman invading their house. And essentially wanting what can't be done, her son being brought back and being a heterosexual person. But what's so powerful is the fact that the older man has some of the icks that the problems that older gay men faced. He lived through the time when the idea of marriage was out of the question, when the idea of getting a kid was out of the question. And the younger man, Bobby Steggert, grew up in a much more liberated era, and as a result, he's much more at home with who he is and what the circumstances are. So that's the power of the play for me, and that's what I really enjoyed seeing. It reminded me, wow, it wasn't that long ago that we were in comparatively dark ages, and look how far we've come in so short of time. And of course, we're all, probably most all who are listening to this podcast, are looking forward to even greater advances as time goes on. And as a result of that, Terrence McNally gives us hope by reminding us how far we've come in a short period of time.
I think, Peter, when you used the word icks, were you quoting from The Boys in the Band?
Yeah, I guess I was. You know, it's, you know, I forgot that's even where I get it from. You know, I guess I could have said Mean Reds and used a Breakfast at Tiffany's analogy. But yeah, that's a good point. So that really was kind of fitting under the circumstances. Yes, you got me there. Go on.
A quote from a far better play, I would say. I didn't like it at all. I thought it was very schematic and melodramatic, and there were many, many things said in it that I don't think people would say to each other, or at least if they did, they would have to immediately stop speaking with each other, and one of them would have to make a complete exit. We first see the Tyne Daly character and the Frederick Weller character, Cal and Catherine, standing looking out of, we learned that they're looking out of his windows on Central Park West, over the park and looking over to the east side. And she's got a fur coat on, which she keeps on for about half an hour. And she keeps saying, I'm leaving, I'm leaving, I'm leaving. But she doesn't leave, nor does she take her coat off. And then finally, he convinces her to take her coat off, and she decides to stay. So none of that made any sense to me. Like, why she would, you know, if she was going to stay, why wouldn't she take her coat off sooner? And why would he be able to persuade her to stay after a half an hour of asking her, and then she finally decides to. But that's just one example. I very much like the idea of the play overall. I just think the execution was extremely poor. Much of the dialogue was very informational and very again, just sounded not natural, and wasn't helped by the fact that I can't imagine why Frederick Weller was cast. He just seemed so wrong for that role. He has a speech pattern that a basic speech pattern and timbre of his voice that he's used in every play that I've seen him in. So I guess that's just how he speaks, you know, and he's not able to, or does not choose to modify it greatly for one reason or another, but it's got a kind of
yes, it does.
a simple, a kind of slow-witted sound to it, which was perfect for his role in Take Me Out and some other roles that he's done, but to me was completely wrong for this extremely well-educated gay man. For what it's worth, now I realize that, this play is supposed to be inspired by, I think that's the word that's used, loosely based on and function as a sort of a sequel to Andre's Mother, which is a short piece that McNally wrote many years ago, and I believe was performed on stage as part of something else. But then, at any rate, turned up on television with Seda Thompson in the Catherine role, and Richard Thomas as Cal. And there could not be two more dissimilar actors or characterizations than Richard Thomas and Frederick Weller. So I'm not saying that the Richard Thomas's way is the only way to do it, but it certainly seemed to ring more true to the character. And Frederick Weller's speech patterns were a constant distraction to me throughout the play, and I could not figure out why he was cast. Although
I will say this, Michael, I know four people who saw it Bucks County when a different actor was playing it, and they have told me that Frederick Weller is 850 times better than the actor that was playing it Bucks County. That's only reportage. I mean, it doesn't mean that it's true, but nevertheless, I have had four people tell me that.
Well, but also let me hasten to clarify. I am not. It's not his acting ability. It's to me the inappropriateness of his vocal sound, his timbre of his voice, and his
speech. There is a hollowness to it. I know what you're talking about. I wouldn't disagree with that.
Yeah, and well, whatever adjective you want to use. And also, I'm going to say this, and I don't even know what it means myself. He does not sound gay. He just doesn't sound gay to me. So, and I realize there are all different kinds of gay men who speak in all different ways, but
yes,
but he does not sound
yes. Wow.
And on the other hand, speaking of speech patterns, boy, you know, I really used to like Bobby Stigert a lot, but I think lately he's become very affected in his attempt to seem natural. He does these things where he kind of puts this laughter in his voice, like, you know, for kind of every other line. And he also he pauses, you know, between words like this, like to make it sound like he's actually thinking of the lines as they're coming. And then he also raises his inflection at the end of every line or every other line, and it really drove me crazy. So I really didn't like him at all. And I think, I don't know if he's been to an acting teacher since he started. He was so incredibly wonderful in Yank and several other things that
110 he was really good in too.
Yes.
This is Big Break, no question.
Several other things that I saw him in at the beginning of his career.
Michael, if you didn't like Frederick Weller, and if you didn't like Bobby Stigert, what did you think of the little boy?
Well, he, I could not understand a word.
That's right.
He's going into Matilda?
except when he was facing directly at me. Then I understood every word he was saying. So I guess it's maybe just largely a question of projection, because the voice itself is so small and also, you know, very high-pitched.
Too bad Ethel Merman isn't around to give him staging lessons, how she used to just look out at the audience and deliver her line. Maybe that's what he needs to do so that he can understand what he's saying. That's a good idea. Come back, Ethel, for more reasons than one, but that's another story.
Well, I'm going to see this next week, but I have to tell you that if my children don't look at me straight in the face, I don't understand a word they say.
Ah!
So I need to have Ethel Merman as my Mary Poppins or something?
Not much else for me to say except, I didn't understand the diary thing either, Peter. We're supposed to think that after Andre died, that I guess for some time Cal saved Andre's diary without reading it a word of it. Yeah. And then at some point decided to send it to Andre's mother, whether or not he assumed she would read it or not. He just wanted her to have it as a keepsake. And then that she saved it for years and years and then brought it back to him for some reason. She saved it without reading it also, and then brought it back to him for no reason. And then after this 20 years of neither one of those people reading the diary, because, it's a diary and it's so private and we would never invade his privacy, suddenly Bobby Stigert opens it and starts reading it.
Yeah, I will admit all that's very contrived. What it seems to me is Terrence McNally wanted to write a play that showed how far we've come in so short a time. And after so many years of not making any steps forward at all. So as a result, that's the power of the play to me, and that's what I liked.
There was a wonderful speech about the generation that we lost. And, you know, because really, I don't think anyone who was not there can really understand what it was like. It was like living in a nightmare. It really
sure was.
And it was, you know, and I think, you know, whether you were gay or straight, but obviously the more people you knew, I mean, you could not open the obituary section, or if you did, you were going to just, you want to kill yourself. It was, it was so horrible.
You bet.
Yeah.
All right. So, we went from Les Mis across the street to Mothers and Sons at the John Golden, and we're going to jump over a couple of blocks to go down to the New Amsterdam Theater where Aladdin has just opened. Peter and I got a chance to see it. In fact, I showed up to the theater with my daughter Charlotte, and Peter was sitting next to me. So we actually, we can not only say that we saw the same show, but we saw it from nearly exactly the same vantage point.
Right. And James got to say hello to my girlfriend Linda during the first act, but not the second act. Not during the second act. She wasn't there.
That's right.
Boy, she got up as if she were prodded by a cattle prod. now here's the thing. I mean, sitting next to James, I know he enjoyed it immeasurably. He laughed like a seal during much of it, you know, and he must have noticed that I did not laugh once. Did you notice that, James?
Well, I thought you're like Ben Brantley. You don't laugh. You know, and to give it away, because I did see that lots of people spying, you know, watching the show, sort of City of Angels type of thing. So I thought maybe you were just keeping your cards covered. And to see if so you didn't think it was as funny as I loved certain parts of it. Certain parts of it I thought were just a very theme parkish, and
that's been said a lot about this show, the theme park element. But what really bothered me, which is something that didn't bother you, I find anachronisms the lowest form of humor. I mean, a lot of people say puns are the lowest form of humor, and I don't get that at all, because sometimes puns can be really, really clever and quite wonderful. So to me, anachronisms are the lowest. And in fact, after a while, I started keeping track. Will there be an anachronism for every letter of the alphabet? Now, let me see if they really covered all the bases. And asking for an X is too much to ask. But I'm telling you, every other letter of the alphabet was represented. And those who tune into my Critcherland column on Friday will find an example of 25 anachronisms representing each letter of the alphabet. So I do like the fact
that... Well, I have to say that you took lemons and made lemonade then.
I guess I did. But I will admit some of those come from the original movie. But Chad Begelin really went to town on this. And by the way, audience... certainly responded to them, so he's doing something right. I do think they had a marvelous idea in early in the show when he and Alan Menken wrote a song for Aladdin saying, "I want my parents to be proud of me." The song is actually called "Proud of Your Boy," and I think it's a very good idea because that's a good value. You know, that's nice. So I like that quite a bit. One of the problems of turning an animated film to an onstage thing, though, you know, in an animated film, you can convincingly, in the early part of the show when Aladdin is trying to escape from people, really make a lot of close calls. Because, you know, you're the animator. You have the power. You can make it look really real. Oh, my God, he just missed there. Oh, they almost got him. You know, that type of thing. Here in the show, the fight direction, I guess it follows on the fight direction, is truly terrible. Aladdin could have been caught 18 times in a minute and a half while he's running around the stage. So that's not convincing at all, and that's a real problem. But they really do go for a cartoon type of feeling. to the point at which I expected Aladdin to burst through a wall and you would see his actual body shape. You know how they do it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it was that much. So I thought that was a bit of a problem. Everybody has been saying like crazy how wonderful the actor who plays Jafar is. And I found it a fine performance.
You mean the genie, don't you?
I'm sorry. No. Yes, that's exactly what I mean. I apologize. Right.
Okay.
Got it right. Thank you. Yes, everybody's been saying how magnificent he is, and maybe I was just thinking I was going to be overwhelmed beyond belief. And he's perfectly fine. God love him. May he live to be 100. But, I mean, there is nothing extraordinary about what he's doing. His name is James Monroe Iglehart. What's really bizarre is that he starts the show as the narrator.
Yeah, and, I heard that.
Yeah.
And my God, there's all this thing about he can't get out of the lamp unless it's rubbed and all that kind of. What's he doing? How do you get out in the first place?
Taken from the movie.
You know, I think that's
no, that's not true. No,
I don't.
It's not the Robin Williams thing taken from the movie.
I don't think so.
No, there's a minor character. The movie starts with a minor character voiced by Bruce Adler from Crazy for You.
Oh yes.
Going through the desert, and he starts to tell. He pulls out the lamp, and then he tells the story of the lamp, and then it's sort of a flashback.
So, I mean, it's such a bizarre thing to me, you know, that it and again, the sense of reality is kind of off. So, so I have to say I had a pretty miserable time in Aladdin, but I like the fact that the audience responded. And you know what? This is a great show to take kids to for the first time, the first trip to ever to the theater, because God knows it's splashy and God knows it looks opulent and the story's easy to follow. And kids love anachronisms. I still remember my little boy, when he was a little boy, sitting in front of the Flintstones and laughing like James Marino did at the show, saying, they didn't have that then, you know, and, you know, so as a result, you know, I do think it's a very good show to take kids to. And I hope they have a wonderful time for years to come. But no, I wasn't putting on any act, James. I just didn't respond to it at all. But I'd much rather you have a good time than agree with me.
Well, the other night I saw Adam Feldman at Rocky, and I was chatting with him at intermission. Adam Feldman from Time Out New York. He's a reviewer for listeners. And I said to him, I said, so what do you think? And he says, oh, I love it. And I said, oh, you know, I wasn't so hot on the first act. And he says, no, you're totally wrong. It's great. I said, you know, Peter Felicius says, I'd rather you have a good time than agree with me.
Yeah.
And Adam says, no, I'd rather you agree with me.
Oh, most people feel that way. You know, I've heard that rebuttal many times when I've said that statement. You know, so,
I remember discussing Caroline or Change with Adam, and in that case, we both were very much on the plus side. But I remember I was trying to play devil's advocate and saying, well, you know, I can understand why some people wouldn't like it because blah, 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 blah. And he said, yeah, but those people are wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, I guess he's the Pope of Broadway, because he's infallible, you know, to say that all those other people are wrong. You know, I mean, yeah, the Pope, you know, how we have a Pope of Broadway. Isn't that something? You know, it's amazing to me when people say, no, they're wrong. You know, I tell you, you know, I mean, John Maas, who listens to these podcasts from time to time, a nice California writer that I've come to meet, so bright, so smart, so wonderful, and we disagree to the nth degree on 1776, and I never say to him, you're wrong. You know, the way things hit you or the way they hit you, who knows what experiences you've had in your life that make you respond to things. There's no right or wrong when it comes to this stuff.
So jump in here before we have to wrap up this segment. This James Monroe Iglehart, that's the genie. The big production number, Friend Like Me. I thought that, you know, if they play that on the Tony Awards, if they do that production number on the Tony Awards, I think that not only is it nearly impossible to get a ticket to Aladdin right now, and it got, you know, mixed reviews. But if they do that on the Tony Awards, you'll never get a ticket to it. And I also think that, he probably will get a nomination out of that.
Oh, easily. In fact, I won't be surprised if he wins the award, because a lot of people are really responding to him. I found it a very fine journeyman performance.
And Jonathan Freeman as Jafar, I think, did great. And Don Darrell Rivera as Iago did great. I thought that Aladdin and Jasmine, sort of like Romeo and Juliet, they were like, okay, they were fine, passable.
They were, yeah.
It must be really neat to see. And as far as I know, this is the first time this has happened. Somebody who voiced a character in one of the big Disney movies, recreating the role on stage.
Yeah.
So Jonathan, that must be so great for him. Two quick things. Proud of your boy Peter. Am I not correct that it was written for the movie and then cut?
Oh, I didn't know that.
I think so. I didn't research it because I didn't know if it was going to come up. And the other thing is, yes, for whatever it's worth, the movie is laden with anachronisms. So, and I could certainly understand why you hate that. I know Matthew Murray, it drives him up the wall. and sometimes it bothers me too. I guess it depends. On if you know going in what you're going to get, and also if they're consistent with it. That helps to me. It's almost like if there were one or two anachronisms, then it would bother me greatly. But if the whole thing is going to be just jokey and full of anachronisms, sometimes that can be okay.
Michael, the playbill has lots of footnotes in it, and Proud of Your Boy has lyrics by Howard Ashman, so it was written a while ago.
I just checked that too.
Tim Rice wrote a bunch of the new lyrics as well.
Yes. Well, that was
and Chad. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Tim Rice. I don't know if he was involved in the adaptation to the stage, but he came in after Howard Ashman sadly died and wrote a lot of the songs in the movie. Yeah.
So there's that for Aladdin. Yeah. I had a great time.
I know you did.
My wife, Laura, and Justin sat on the other side of the theater, so we had four of us at the theater that evening. And I have to tell you, a family of four going to see a Broadway show is $1,000, but that's a whole other podcast.
Kettle of fish.
that we can talk
about. This just occurred to me the other day, and I mean, I'm amazed that it took me so long to realize this, but, you know, everybody talks about how there's less coverage of Broadway now, and the outlets and shrinking of coverage, critics aren't being hired anymore, freelance basis, all that kind of stuff. What it must have something to do with is the fact that there's a certain percentage of the public that now feels they're going to ignore Broadway because they could never afford it. So as a result, there's going to be fewer readers who are interested. They're just turning their back on it. And the obvious rebuttal is, well, wait a minute, Broadway shows are doing very well. There are a lot of tickets sold. Yeah, but when you think of how many more people there are in the world now than there used to be in the 50s, and how much more tourism there is now than there used to be in the 50s, which is one of the golden ages, well, you know, it might very well be that a lot of people aren't going to read about something they know that is completely out of their league financially, and they're never going to partake of. So I think that may have a lot to do with it. You know,
Good point.
Yeah. As I said, we don't have time to talk about this right now, but in the good old days when we had 50, 60, 70 Broadway theaters and seven dailies that covered it and things like that, I wonder what the relationship from, you know, number of reviewers to the number of seats sold were type of thing. I don't know. We'd have to see that. So let's move forward. Peter got a chance to get up to Providence, Rhode Island, where he's at Trinity Rep, and he saw Oliver. So Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, you know, it never occurred to me before that there is no musical that deserves an exclamation point less than Oliver, because exclamation point indicates a type of excitement and optimism that you can find in Oklahoma and Fiorello and Hello, Dolly. But, you know, Oliver's a really dark show, and this one was darker still for a couple of reasons, one of which they dropped I Shall Scream, which is the duet between the widow and Mr. Bumble, which is a funny song. And the thing is, the scene late in the show where those two are now married and complain about being married is the only levity that's in that show. Otherwise, it's really a very serious show. And Richard Jenkins and his wife, whose name escapes me. I feel terrible. I can't think of it right now. Directed the show together, and they really made the show much darker than I've ever seen it before. And there was one misstep as a result of that, but one tremendous masterstroke. The masterstroke was the fact that Bill Sykes, who's a very difficult character, who almost always comes in acting like he's the cock of the walk and rules the world and really thinks he's this real tough guy who's invincible, here was played in a way that suggested he hated himself. He can't believe that he wound up in this situation, that it's really come to this. He really has a conscience in this show. Of course he hits Nancy. Of course he kills Nancy. But strangely enough, the way that it was directed here, you almost felt that this Bill Sykes was killing Nancy in a way of killing himself, that he was really trying to, this is the way, the only way he knew to weed out evil, even though she wasn't evil. I mean, he just didn't know what to do. I've never seen this character played so spectacularly in that way, and I really, really appreciated it so much. And I thought it really solved a problem, because everybody hates the fact that Bill is abusive to Nancy. At least if he regrets it, that helps it tremendously. However, a great misstep occurred later, because here's, as we all know, after he hits her, she sings "As Long As He Needs Me." Now, that's tough to take. In 1960, when the show opened in London, 63, when it opened on Broadway, we were just starting to get away from that feeling seriously. I mean, there was a time when men hitting their wives wasn't thought of anything at all. I mean, even in Fiorello, there's that lyric, if he strikes me, you know, she accepts it. You know, I mean, Sheldon Harnick eventually rewrote that lyric. But nevertheless, in 1959, that was part of married life. We were appalled by that now, but nevertheless, that was the case. So it wasn't as potent and as horrifying as it is now. And they made it worse in Providence, because what they did was have her bleed profusely after he hit her. Oh. You know, so there she is singing the song with blood running out of her nose. And I mean, you know, that's a very bad idea. When I saw Bill Sykes really hating himself, I said, oh, this is so great, because they've solved that problem. You know, I mean, one of the wonderful things about the actress who played Nancy is that she was very maternal. When she came in to do It's a Fine Life, she just looked at those kids and beamed. She just loved them. So you could say, all right, she's the type of person who just likes to love. And maybe that's one of the reasons she likes Bill Sykes. But my God, when blood's running down your face, you have other concerns than singing how much you love the guy who just made that happen. You know, so I think that's a problem. Done on a unit set, very much the Jekyll and Hyde of Vita type set with the bridge, that type of thing. Very effective, moved very well, in fact. The thing I may have mentioned last week about Rocky, I looked at my watch and I expected 50 minutes, the 20 minutes had passed and it had been 50. Same thing here, to the penny. I said, oh, it must be 20 minutes, and it was 50. So, I mean, and I know the show. I mean, I shouldn't have even thought about that in that context. So, very nice. But I'll tell you, those out there who want to do Oliver, think about making Bill Sykes about a guy who really, really isn't happy with what he's become, that he's ashamed of it and guilty about it. It really helps the show immeasurably.
All right. So Michael got a chance to see Helmut versus McCarthy at the Abington Theater Company. Michael, give us a quick 5 minutes on that.
Yes, I really liked it overall, despite some problems. And also, you know, a point I wanted to make is that I hate to say this, but I completely understand why. This is one of a couple of shows recently I've seen that are, I say, the equivalent of off Broadway. And I saw both of them early in the run, and I really felt like they would have benefited from a few more days of running it. Now, one might say that, yes, ideally every show should be ready, completely ready for an audience by opening night. But I think we have to bear in mind the realities of economics, and especially at that level, you know, anyway, that these people are, you know, it's probably, I mean, some of them may have day jobs. It's the money that they're receiving for rehearsals is infinitesimal compared to what they would get on Broadway or even a major off-Broadway theater. So I think that's just the reality, and absolutely, if you see something on Broadway or, you know, one of the major institutional theaters, I think you're entitled to expect a finished product by opening night. But when you are going to see something much smaller, bear in mind, if you don't have to see it right at the beginning, you might want to wait a few days and let it gel. And that applied, I think, to Helman v. McCarthy in terms of, aside from everything else, that there was quite a bit of line stumbling when I saw it. But there are so many lines in this play. It's about the epic feud between Lillian Hellman and Mary McCarthy that was caused basically and specifically by an appearance that Mary McCarthy had on the Dick Cavett Show back in the day, where she said that every word Lillian Hellman has ever written has been a lie, including "an" and "the," or maybe it's "an" and "but." I always forget.
I think it was the. There were
two versions. She actually says in the play that she said two different versions of it at two different times. We have Lillian Hellman played very well, played very well by Roberta Maxwell. Although, to be honest, her voice is nothing like that gravelly thing that Lillian Hellman spoke in her later years after God knows how many decades of smoking and heavy drinking. But extremely well acted because it is Roberta Maxwell. And Mary McCarthy is Marcia Rodd, doing a wonderful job. And Dick Cavett is playing himself. And this was an interesting thing. At the beginning of the show, where there are two other guys who play multiple roles, and they kind of are acting as if they're preparing an audience for the actual Dick Cavett Show back in the day. And then he comes out and he does a few minutes of stand-up, and then he starts to talk about his upcoming guest, Mary McCarthy. Mary McCarthy was a great actress who was in Follies and Chicago. Different person. This is Mary McCarthy, the author. So at first you think, well, I guess Dick Cavett is playing himself then, even though obviously he's much older now. And then the interview proceeds, and then you assume that it's probably verbatim. I didn't actually check that out, but I assume so. But then later on, after that, there are many scenes in various locales. But Cavett, after that, turns up only as a kind of walk-through narrator to kind of explain things at various points. And then you think he's playing himself now. So it was a little confusing in the beginning, but ultimately it was. I think it actually was a plus that he was almost playing himself both then and now. You know, and mm-hmm. He did it very well. His voice has not changed at all. He looks great for, I believe he's 80 or something around there. And he was really quite terrific, even though, again, some stumbling. But also in his case, I couldn't tell how much of what he was saying was scripted and how much of it was sort of extemporaneous. And that actually made the whole thing more interesting as well. So I really advise seeing this play. I thought it was very, very interesting. One issue that it raises is, and you know, Peter mentioned 1776, which it's a somewhat similar case. When you see something like this that's presented as a sort of a docudrama, it can be difficult to know how much of what's being said is supposed to be real, you know, and supposed to be actually from interviews and books and whatever. And I have to do the research because there are some incredible things said in here during the interview with Cavett. So I guess this must be true. Mary McCarthy goes on what an absolutely horrible writer John Steinbeck was. And then at another point in a scene that's not in an interview, Lillian Hellman is talking about Candide. And do you know what she says? She says that half fag Bernstein screwed it up.
My God. I don't know which part of the sentence to be more appalled by.
I know, exactly. So I am going to have to see if I can find through Google or whatever if Lillian Hellman ever said anything like that about Bernstein. And if she did, then I don't even know how to respond to that.
Talk
about delusion as far as who screwed up Candide, and also what a horrible thing to say.
Speaking of Dick Cavett. I pulled out my album of Cyrano, the new musical based upon the play by Edmund Rostand, music and book by Richard Maltby Jr., music by David L. Shire, settings by John Conklin, and this was done at Yale. It was such a big success. In fact, Barbara Streisand recorded one of the songs called Autumn. It was such a big success that they actually made a cast album, and it's so fascinating to look and see who was in it. Ragueneau was played by Richard Cavett. Lisa was played by Carrie Nye McGoy. So she was married already, and I guess she and Mr. Cavett got together during this production. I'm inferring that, I'll grant you. John Cunningham, an actor we certainly know, played Cyrano. Austin Pendleton was in it too, playing simply Ragueneau's assistant, but there he was, you know, Bill Hinnant. We certainly know from many appearances in the 60s, was a porter. And for those of us who are baseball fans, Bartlett Giamatti, who later became the commissioner later became the commissioner of baseball, had a small role too. So yes, Dick Cavett has been around for a long time, and starting with Cyrano at Yale.
So Dick Cavett, when's the last time that we have seen him?
Rocky Horror.
Yeah.
Was it Rocky Horror, the narrator?
Indeed. Yeah, he took over that role.
Sort of thinking that, did he do something after, but I guess it wasn't Broadway.
Maybe not. Yeah. And by the way, of course, A. Bartlett Giamatti also became the father of Paul Giamatti.
Yeah. Indeed. That's right.
Right, yeah, good point.
In his most famous role.
Yes. But...
I don't know. All right, so... Peter, you got a chance to see Music Man at NJ PAC. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yes. Now, this was really fascinating because this was a concert version. This was not a full production. There were 75 fewer trombones than you'd want to expect because it was a very small orchestra. And there were very few actors, too. There were only 11 of them. Evans Hale, who runs a theater in Cape Cod and is a fine musician, a scholar, did the adaptation. And what he's done, he's dropped Tommy, Gilles, and Zanita. And it's very interesting how you don't really need them to... he also dropped one of the members of the Barbershop Quartet. Now, before you go crazy and say, what? The thing is, he makes Mayor Shin one of those people. I think that's very clever, actually. I think it helps it immeasurably, frankly, also now Mayor Shin is more distracted than he, because he keeps on talking about, I want to get those guys that guy's credentials, you know. And the point is, well, why not do something about it? So if he's actually in the Barbershop Quartet, that helps that. So this was really something. It was also done by an African-American cast. And what was really unnerving, but certainly impressive at the beginning, in the train sequence, it said for colored passengers over the train, you know, and that reminded us, I wish that sign would have gone away after that opening scene, but I'm sorry to say it stayed there for the entire show. Oh. And that was, maybe that's what they wanted. You know, it's entirely possible that that's what they wanted to remind us of the Jim Crow laws. But Isaiah Washington was an excellent Harold Hill. And, you know, this lends itself to the African-American experience because Wells Fargo Wagon became virtually a hand-clapping type number. I mean, You Got Trouble almost became a spiritual, you know. I mean, and in a way, when you think of it, you know, there is the religious feeling behind that number. So it really worked extraordinarily well. And Stephanie Umo, who many of us really adored when she was Sarah in the revival of Ragtime, played Marion, and wasn't she wonderful, as you would expect her to be. So. But my point is, you don't have to do it with an African-American cast, but if you like Music Man and your theater doesn't have many resources and you're worrying, you know, it can be done on the cheap. And more to the point, it really lends itself to a concert presentation because think about it. In that opening scene where everybody's on the train, everybody has a seat. And therefore, they have the chairs in place for the rest of the show when they're not being used as actors. You know, they're just naturally there. So it really does lend itself to it. So anybody out there who said, oh, I'd love to do Music Man, but I can't afford it. Maybe you can. Look at this version because the show is so wonderful and strong that it can withstand the trims and the other adaptations that took place. So I highly recommend people taking a look at this concert versions by Evans Hale.
Well, Peter, great. You half joked last week. How did My White Knight work?
Oh, you know, that's very that's really interesting because, and I checked the script. I wanted to see if they had added the line in, you know, just to be on the safe side. But I'm telling you, it is true that the actual line that is in My White Knight, that Meredith Willson actually gave before the song starts, is, "I'm not waiting for a man in shining white armor."
Oh, yes, yes. Absolutely.
So as a result, you know, I think that covers it. You know, it's the clothes that make the man here. You know, it's not a case that she means white as Caucasian. You know, so
I was joking, and I assumed you were joking.
I really didn't know that. I didn't know about the line about the white armor. So I mean, that's, and boy, did I come home and take out my copy to make sure that was there. You know, that they weren't any. But you know, it's interesting because after that first scene, in essence, it was non-traditional casting because Mrs. Peru, played by Myra Lucretia Taylor, an actress I very much like, used an Irish brogue unapologetically. I mean, you know, and all that stuff about being Irish was in there, and nobody laughed at all. Because once again, as the movie 40 Carats proved, and maybe I never saw the play, maybe this is in the play too, when Lee Ullman is very upset that she's in love with this much younger boy, and what are people going to think? And Gene Kelly, her former husband, says to her, "People take their cue from you. If you're uncomfortable, they'll be uncomfortable." And Myra Lucretia Taylor did it with such brio that... okay, she's Irish, that's it. You know, there was no laughter at all because she wouldn't let us laugh because she was so secure in what she was doing.
All right, so that's a really great tip if you want to do a Music Man and you don't think you can do it. That's look at this production. Mm. I went from one extreme of a small production to the other extreme where I went to go see Cirque du Soleil's Amaluna. And they say it's at City Field, but it's actually in the parking lot of City Field. They actually build their own theater in the parking lot. It's under a big tent, and it's really amazing from both a technology standpoint all the way through the performers and the physicalness of this. But the twist that was interesting for me is that Diane Paulus, who is a much lauded director of Broadway shows, is now has directed this Amaluna production of Cirque du Soleil, and it is really, really interesting and amazing. I don't think I would quite call it theater. There is somewhat of a storyline going through this, but it's similar to, you know, all the other Cirque du Soleil shows. If you've ever seen a Cirque du Soleil, they do have a theme in them, but it's just the impressive physical nature and cleverness of how they are getting the point across is really amazing. And it's going to be playing through May 18th, and so we have a link to it in the show notes. And if you are a Cirque du Soleil fan, I would encourage you to get out there and see it. And it was I brought my kids, 10 and 6, and they had a great time, and my wife and I had a great time. So, and there's, as the saying says, not a bad seat in the house, and there's 2,600 of them. So get out there to see it.
Well, it's very interesting to me, though, that Diane Paulus should be part of this because there's no secret that many of the Cirque du Soleil shows in recent years have not done well. So the fact that they've enlisted her, figuring, well, we better get somebody in here who can help us, is pretty potent stuff. So so good for Diane Paulus, who certainly is becoming a major force in American theater, isn't she?
Well, I was thinking about the business side of it, and that they're not doing it Radio City Music Hall. You know, the last Cirque du Soleil show in New York was at Radio City, I think it was, and they reportedly took a financial bath there, and so I think a little, it's probably much less expensive to do it in the way that they're doing it now. I'm guessing. I don't know that for sure, but certainly they are able to control much more of the environment by putting up their own stage rather than using an existing stage. It's very impressive. But I mentioned before the before we started recording that I wasn't sure if things were stolen from Pippin or if Pippin stole things from Cirque du Soleil, because there certainly was a handful of things that were very similar. On Channel 4, the local NBC affiliate station this morning, they had an interview with Diane Paulus talking about Cirque and Ama Luna. And the reporter said, you know, Diane has conquered Broadway now, and now she's always wanted to direct the circus, and she's done that, and now she's moving on to film and television, which I hadn't heard. Had you guys heard about Diane Paulus doing any film and television work?
No. I'm not sure, but she has one or two other theater projects coming up that I can't think of at the moment, but I know she does.
Yeah, and plus running ART and things like that. So, all right, so anything else from you guys?
I wanted to correct a mispronunciation I made from last week. I think James brought up how, aside from everything else, how really good looking a lot of the people in Rocky are.
Yeah.
And one of those hot boxers, I mispronounced his name. It's Luis Salgado, not Luis Delgado. So I just wanted to correct that for the record. He's done several Broadway shows, including In the Heights.
Well, you know, I wonder how Rocky and Aladdin and these other very physical big shows, how they're going to affect some of the Broadway Cares things like Broadway Bears.
Oh, yeah, good point.
You know, you're going to have whole new waves of people in to see these shows there.
I don't know. It's funny you say that, because we can talk further next week. But I saw Heathers last night, and the two guys who played the dumb jocks spend the entirety of Act Two in underwear.
they sold a lot of tickets, Michael.
Because they're killed while in their underwear, and then I guess the theory is that you appear as a ghost in whatever you were wearing when you died. I don't know.
I see.
So every time they come back, they're in these little jockey shorts. So there you go, guys.
All right, so we'll have to talk about that next week, and maybe we'll see if there's a YouTube video or something floating around with it. So anything we're coming towards the end of the season. We have a lot of shows to see in the next couple of weeks. How is your schedule looking, both of you?
There is the One Night Guys and Dolls this Thursday at Carnegie Hall. I have no idea if there are tickets still available, but you might want to check that out, because it's Nathan Lane, Megan Mullally, and Patrick Wilson, quite a great cast, and it's going to be a great orchestra, obviously. Guys and Dolls, Carnegie Hall, Thursday the 3rd at 7:30 p.m.
Are you going, Michael?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
I will report on it.
Peter?
Well, I'm going to be seeing If Then and Raisin in the Sun here in New York, but I'm also going to see Kate Burton in The Seagull in Boston. I'm going to see Ain't Misbehaving in Delaware and Arstic and Old Lace in Philadelphia. So it's going to be busy for me.
Frequent flyer miles. All right. So before we wrap up, I wanted to say that if you are somebody who listens to these podcasts and really enjoys them, there is another theater podcast out there called the Maximu Podcast. We had Lindsay Barron's on here a few weeks ago, and I have been listening to the Maximu Podcast, and I really encourage, if you like what we're doing here, get over there and take a listen to them. She's got some great interviews and great discussions on theater in New York, and they focus a lot about theater beyond Broadway, where we're focusing a lot of theater on Broadway. They had two interviews, one with Peter Michael Marino, who I am not related to and I've never met, and Kirk Lynn, who's a playwright and a performer, and from Rude Mechanicals. And so get over there and take a listen to that. There's some good work that Lindsay and the group are doing over the Maximu podcast.
Can you spell Maximu, because I didn't get
Maximu it. Is M-A-X-A-M-O-O.
Okay, great.
So maximoo.com, maximoo.com. And I think that it is Lindsay's nephew. His name is Max, and he said Maximoo once, and that's how it got its name. All right. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a link that way each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. You can listen to us in another way. You can listen to us one way is on the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device. And This Week on Broadway will be automatically streamed to you. We also are played on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, and me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things that we've talked about today. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Let him live.